Hey, everybody. Welcome to a Canary Cry Flyby. My name is Gons. Basil is inside the baseball right now, so he will not be joining us for this episode. However, this is a very important episode because I'm going to share a piece of the draft of Age of Deceit 4, Eschaton Cipher, and the Counterfeit Ledger of Life. And I'm also going to extend an invitation to any of you watching or listening out there who want to help shape the film by providing feedback. Now, that feedback could be editorial, it could be critical, it could be informational, you know, additional information that I can add. I can't promise that it's going to be included or be used in the final version of the film, but I think it's a way to make the film that is going to be very cool and communal and something that I think we can do moving into the future if it all works out well. So what I want you to do is go to canarycry.party. It's a website, it's a URL. If you're watching the video, you're looking at it right here. It's a bunch of links. It's our link tree. You can get your text notification. You can join the mailing list where we actually send you the show notes to all of our Canary Cry News Talk episodes or any publishing of Canary Cry Radio episodes. That third button down, it says canarycry.tube and AOD4 focus group. Click on that and it will take you to a page that shows you a little header with a little guy with the headphones, and it shows that we are 27% of the way to hitting our goal of funding this project of becoming more digitally sovereign as Canary Cry, so that we don't rely so much on YouTube or even Rumble or X or any of these platforms to provide the content, you know, freely for everybody. So that's something that we're working on. And as part of that, if you hop in and help out, you can be part of this Age of Deceit 4 focus group. It's a way for you to be part of the process, especially if you are someone who has been on this journey with us right from the beginning, Age of Deceit, Fallen Angels, and the New World Order, which was published back in 2011. And I had no idea that it was going to reach so many millions of people. It was not the plan, but the Lord had plans that I did not with the film. So it's something that, you know, it has blessed my life and my family and everything. So it has been a big part of my life. But continuing on to Age of Deceit 2, Alchemy and the Rise of the Beast Image in 2014, which is crazy. That was 10 years ago. And then in 2018, Age of Deceit 3, Remnants in the Cyberhive Earth. All these films had build up. They had years of research, experience, and there's build up. You can't just make a documentary just to make a documentary. There has to be a passion there. There has to be a leading of the Holy Spirit, as far as I'm concerned, especially with these Age of Deceit films. If it's not time, it's not time. That's why it's been 6 years since the last film. And in those 6 years, a lot has happened. I've had a couple of kids. The one thing that's been constant is the research for Age of Deceit. And actually, there were multiple times throughout these last 6 or so years where I thought, okay, I'm ready to publish this film. I even have an edited version. But for whatever reason, whether it was a technical barrier or maybe something that was led by the Lord, it didn't get published. It didn't even make it to anybody that would actually care about the film and even want to give feedback. So anyway, this is way outside of my comfort zone when it comes to producing a documentary. It is way outside of what I'm used to, but I think it's something that's important, especially because this community of people, you guys listening, you guys watching, you've been with us on this journey. And I think there is value in being a part of the production of this film and putting your name to it. So I think this is a very cool opportunity. Now, if you are already in the focus group or you're thinking about jumping in, what is going to happen is you're going to see parts of the film ahead of time, parts like I'm going to show you today. And then you'll fill something out. It allows you to put in information that I can see and receive. We can vet it. We can quantify it. We can put it in nice little spreadsheets for me to look at and everything else. And it's something that can really help me constructively move forward with the film. And what's interesting is that the incentives are aligning in the sense that the topic that I'm talking about in Age of Deceit 4, this Eschaton Cipher, this counterfeit ledger of life, and all of the things happening, it is a social commentary on the technological revolution as we continue to live it out, but also what it means for the church and how we are going to survive some of these changes. And some of the technological changes happening are on the premise of going back to constitutional rights and, you know, personal rights and things of that nature, which is interesting because a lot of the internet its first iteration, appeared on the scene in public as a sort of, you know, printing press type of moment where, hey, this is for freedom. This is for freedom of information and for dissemination and everything else. And that, you know, we know how that turned out in just a few short years. So with the emergence of blockchain, AI, quantum, these are topics that I think are relevant to eschatology and really reveal where we are on the prophetic timeline and how close we are to the end. And I'm not saying we know for sure when Jesus is returning, but gotta say, the more I live my life, the more it seems like we're definitely living in the days of Noah. Pretty undeniable. So the canary cry tube side of this is the sovereignty side, the self-sovereignty when it comes to being able to provide the content. The idea is that anybody can come and access our content for free. And, you know, the whole goal is for you to be able to do that without YouTube, without Rumble, without X, without Odyssey, without any of these platforms, doing it ourselves, which is a tall order, but it's something that we're planning to build here. And we think it's something that every believer, especially if you're going to be online in the future, is going to have to do. So as things go from online to on chain, this will matter a lot. I'll share more about what to expect if you're already part of the focus group or you're thinking about joining after I share a few clips from what I have here in the edit bay. Now, I'm going to do this director's cut style where I'm just going to play straight out of Adobe Premiere where I am editing this, and I will, you know, periodically stop it, comment, or whatever. I am not going to play, at least for the public here, the intro sequence. I have an intro gospel sequence as well as the theme song short segment with some quotes from some prominent people and relevant information. But I want to go ahead and start playing the film from the first section here, which introduces the topic of eschatology and cryptography, and does so in the context of where we are in the realm of computing. So again, bear with me here. Here we go.
This electronic display emanating from Australia's largest computer is a picture of the condition, past, present, and future of planet Earth. The program was originally devised by a scientist working from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Jay Forrester. It was developed under the auspices of the Club of Rome by an MIT research team to present a complex model of the world and what we humans are doing to it. The program, called World One, doesn't pretend to be a precise forecast. What it does for the first time in man's history on the planet is to look at the world as one system. It shows that Earth cannot sustain present population and industrial growth for much more than a few decades. It's like an electronic guided tour of our global behavior since 1900 and where that behavior will lead us.
As man continues to go deeper into the machine, the veil between this realm and the unseen realm are slowly dissolving. The resulting re-enchantment of society is here. Digital immutability, anti-gravity tech, quantum computing, bioengineering of all life forms, artificial sentience, wrapped in the resurrection of ancient languages, cultures, spiritualities, and pantheons can only be understood properly in the context of biblical truth and eschatology. Many people around the world, not just followers of Christ, are recognizing the fact that the world today is, as it were, in the days of Noah. The remnant church will be those who hold steadfast to the faith and not be swayed by the doctrines of demons that will become ever more present, not just in our faces through screens, but biologically through all kinds of nefarious agendas. From the authors of the text who are inspired by the Holy Spirit to our current generation drenched in data, the truth of God's word is only becoming ever more present, especially as it pertains to eschatology or the end times. One thread that proves this thesis is the topic of computing and cryptography. All right, just want to pause it there for a second. So there you go. There's the introduction, and really just wanted to summarize the idea that we're living in the days of Noah. And don't want to stretch it out too much. I've mentioned it so many times over the years that I think, and I've explored it in so many different ways with the Face Like the Sun channel, almost on a daily basis. So there's no need to reiterate that point over and over again, but I wanted to frame it because the more we enter this reenchantment, the more we enter this era, you can tell that secular society, not your religious folks per se, but there's still a large contingent of people that who are secular, especially in America and the West here, and they are really carrying the torch for the technological changes. And these are the folks that are tapping into ancient forms of thought, ancient mythology, ancient religion, ancient occult religion, mystery school religions, and it's all being resurrected in the context of modernity in this technological revolution. And as the film documents, and as I've documented over the years, it seems that especially when it comes to this blockchain revolution and this crypto revolution, the tendencies, the personalities, the archetypes, and really the imprints and literally perhaps the spirits of some of these ancient entities appear to be reigniting. And there's something called the Nibiru chain. I don't know if anybody's been looking at the crypto markets. It's been pretty wild the last few weeks, but there's something called the Nibiru chain that's about to come out. And so, you know, people are investing in Nibiru chain, which I don't know. We're just a few steps away from, you know, Satan chain or Antichrist chain. In fact, you go into the depths of the crypto markets, you could probably find somebody that's already made those coins, but it doesn't really matter. That's a whole different conversation. But okay, let's dive into this cryptography and eschatology segment, because I tried to summarize quickly the history of cryptography and how it relates to eschatology and why it's important for us to understand at least known history with this topic of cryptography, because there's some cool things that happened in the past, but a lot changed in the last 150 years or so. The origins of cryptography is debated amongst scholars and historians, but in general, early examples include artistic hieroglyphs from ancient Egypt and a Mesopotamian cuneiform from 1500 BC that had a camouflaged or encrypted recipe for a highly coveted pottery glaze inscribed on the tablet. However, the first well-documented and clear use of cryptography for secret communication was by the ancient Greeks. The Spartan military used a device called a citale during the 5th century BC. This device involved wrapping a strip of parchment around a rod of a certain diameter. When unwrapped, the parchment appeared to contain a meaningless jumble of letters, but when wrapped around a rod of the same diameter, the original message could be read. This was one of the earliest forms of a transposition cipher, where the order of the characters in the message is rearranged to achieve encryption. Okay, before we go on, just real quick, this sort of an editorial note, and this is the kind of thing that you can help me out with in the focus group. I looked at the word citale. That's how it was pronounced where I looked at it. I looked at a few more places. Some people were saying skytale, some people skitale. So that's just one of those things where I don't know exactly how I'm supposed to pronounce it, but I just did it the way I found it the first few times. So citale, but maybe it's citale. I don't know. The Atbash cipher is a great example of how ciphers were used until the dawn of modern computing and encryption. Oxford Theology describes the Atbash as, quote, a simple substitution code where the first letter of the alphabet, Aleph, is replaced by the last, Tav, the second letter, Bet, by the second last, Sin or Shin, etc. The name Atbash refers to the first letter of the names of these Hebrew characters, Aleph, Tav, Bet, and Shin. These styles of ciphers were common throughout history, with perhaps the most popular being the Caesar cipher, which has a similar letter replacement method. But there are passages in the Old Testament that scholars have documented as ciphers used perhaps for poetic purposes or as a means of communication undercover in a time when such writings may have gotten people in danger with the authorities. Jeremiah 25, verse 26, in the King James Bible says, "And all the kings of the north, far and near, one with another, and all the kingdoms of the world, which are upon the face of the earth, and the king of Sheshach shall drink after them." Our focus is on the mention of the king of Sheshach, who shall drink after them. If you apply the Atbash code, you can decipher Sheshach as Babylon. The New Living Translation and English Standard Version both have the deciphered version of the passage by writing Babylon instead of Sheshach. Jeremiah 51:41 also mentions Sheshach, the Atbash cipher for Babylon. But there is another example of a Atbash cipher in Jeremiah chapter 51, verse 1. To understand this Atbash cipher, we will compare the King James and the New King James. The King James says, "Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up against Babylon and against them that dwell in the midst of them that rise up against me, a destroying wind." The New King James says, "Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up against Babylon and against those who dwell in Leb Kamai, a destroying wind." Notice how Leb Kamai is mentioned in the NKJV, but the KJV has, quote, "them that rise up against me." That is because this is another Atbash cipher for Chaldea. The only translations that had mentioned Chaldea or Chaldeans in this passage are the New American Bible, Brenton Septuagint Translation, and the Amplified Bible. In a lecture series titled Understanding Cryptography, Christoph Parr mentioned how ciphers had been done the same way for thousands of years until 1883, when a Dutch linguist named Dr. August Kerckhoff presented a principle by which all modern cryptography is built.
Crypto started 2000 before Christ, you know, so really old. But this time, people have been doing encryption and decryption for about 4,000 years, right? And they did it essentially wrong.
When talking about the security of a crypto system, Kerckhoff's principle is of main importance. In 1883, Auguste Kerckhoff published his thoughts on possible ways to construct a secure crypto system. In total, he published six basic principles, of which the second one is known nowadays as Kerckhoff's principle. It states that a crypto system should be secure, even if everything about the system, except the key, is public knowledge. If a third party obtains a key, it is much easier to replace the key than a complete crypto system. It is much more difficult to keep a crypto system secret in contrast to single keys.
Kerckhoff's principle, which posits that a cryptographic system should be secure even if everything about the system, except the key, is public knowledge, fundamentally shifted the focus of cryptographic security to the secrecy of the key rather than the obscurity of the algorithm, thereby promoting the development of more robust and universally secure encryption methods.
Okay, let's take a break right there. And just wanted to chat a bit about that segment. So the big takeaway right there being that up until 1883, the whole method of encryption relied on the actual encryption method, meaning the Caesar cipher or the Atbash cipher, which the Bible seems to clearly have, which is very interesting. Now, I know there's topics like the Bible code and there are other things. I actually, interestingly enough, I read the book, The Bible Code, back in high school before I was a believer, which is one of those weird sort of, I don't know, God things in my life, but I may or may not talk about the Bible code. I've been researching it quite a bit recently, and I even tried to get my hands on an actual application that runs allegedly the Bible code. I haven't been able to exactly do it. But the issue with the Bible code itself is that it is extracting modern events, so to speak. It's not useful in the sense that you can analyze the word itself. I mean, you can in a sense, but because it's kind of a grid nature, you can pretty much form any word. And I get it. It's like the nearness of a word in a pattern with another word. So you got like plane and then towers, and you know, you get that kind of matrix when you allegedly go through and look for things in the Bible code, as they say. But again, it's very eisegetical in that sense. You're extrapolating and looking for modern events, and how are you supposed to find modern things in there if it happened already? Or I guess you can project with things like artificial. That's what I wanted to do to get my hands on the software. So this is one of those things where if there is more to it, if there's something more interesting with it, I'm happy to talk about it or include it in the film. But as of now, it may be a mention, but there's nothing too substantial about it, because I wanted to stick to things that can be publicly, or at least in the realm of academics, you know, validated in a sense, because, you know, people care about that stuff. Not that everything that comes out of certain outlets is true. It's just that it's where the most quote unquote credibility is. Of course, that is crumbling, that is changing. And that's a part of the discussion, as well as how these types of trust pillars change over time. And this is something that comes into conversation with the topic of Bitcoin, which we get into here. Let's get back to this segment here, getting into this section called "The Bitcoin is a Biological Blockchain." And this is when it starts getting a little wild. Okay, a little. It's not deep end. There's plenty of documentation on it, but it's just one of those things that people don't think about, especially right now when people are just thinking about how many dollars Bitcoin is. But I think eschatologically, there is something a lot more going on here. And so here we go. Here's the section. Less than 100 years later, Whitfield Diffie and Martin E. Hellman, members of the IEEE, published a paper in 1976, now available at stanford.edu, titled "New Direction in Cryptography." This was a seminal paper that introduced the concepts of public key cryptography and digital signatures. Their work laid the foundation for the development of secure digital communication, impacting various applications such as secure email, electronic commerce, and the secure transmission of confidential information. Their introduction of public key cryptography solved the key distribution problem and enabled secure, anonymous communication over the internet, revolutionizing digital security and facilitating the growth of the digital economy. 33 years later, in 2009, an anonymous programmer named Satoshi Nakamoto published the Bitcoin white paper. While Diffie and Hellman's paper introduced the concept of public key cryptography, Satoshi Nakamoto's Bitcoin white paper applied these principles to create a decentralized electronic cash system using cryptographic techniques for secure peer-to-peer transactions without needing a trusted third party. Diffie and Hellman did not address the issue of double spending in digital currencies. Everyone today understands how easy it is to copy and paste something in digital form. Nakamoto's work directly tackled this double spending problem inherent in digital cash by introducing the blockchain, a decentralized ledger that records all transactions across a network of computers, ensuring that each digital coin is spent only once. Diffie and Hellman introduced a breakthrough in encrypted communications, but still operated within the traditional framework of digital security that could involve central authorities. The Bitcoin protocol, by contrast, completely removed the need for central authorities, using a decentralized network and consensus mechanism, proof of work, to maintain trust and security in the system. This represented a significant shift towards a trustless, decentralized digital economy. But it is this very breakthrough with blockchain technologies and decentralization of digital systems that has unveiled the biological nature of computing. a paper published on the National Center for Biotechnology Information titled, When is Self-Organization Used in Biological Systems? The abstract states, quote, self-organization, or decentralized control, is widespread in biological systems, including cells, organisms, and groups. It is not, however, the universal means of organization. I argue that a biological system will be self-organized when it possesses a large number of subunits, and these subunits either lack the communicational abilities or the computational abilities, or both, that are needed to implement centralized control. I stress that the subunits in a self-organized system do not necessarily have low cognitive abilities. A lack of pre-adaptations for evolving a system-wide communication network can prevent the evolution of centralized control. Hence, sometimes even systems whose subunits possess high cognitive abilities will be self-organized. End quote. It's interesting that this author would reference biological methods as computational abilities, as well as suggesting intelligent supervisors needed to monitor the transactions and an evolving adaptation into a system-wide communication network that can prevent centralization, which can be applied directly to Bitcoin and the larger breakthroughs in blockchain technology. Blockchain expert and serial entrepreneur Trent McConaughey at the Tech Festival in 2018 spoke about Nature 2.0 in How Blockchain Will Transform Nature.
The title, as you see, is Nature 2.0, The Cradle of Civilization Gets an Upgrade. A tree is a very local sort of thing, right? It's taking in nutrients from the soil. It's taking in rain and other moisture from the air, CO2, of course. So this is actually very important in the energy ecosystem. It's taking in sun as well, right? It's a really great solar collector, highly efficient too. We strive as humans to get nearly as efficient as trees. And it's in symbiosis with its environment, right? With the squirrels, with the owls, with the earthworms, and so on, right? Trees, they don't have an identity. They don't know who they are. They don't care. They don't have ownership, per se. They don't have an idea of scarcity. They don't have an idea of money or value. They just are. They're self-sustaining. And even more than just self-sustaining, they're actually anti-fragile. If you kick them, they get stronger. That's the very essence of anti-fragility. So not just about resilience, but actually getting stronger when you're down. And it's not just trees, right? We can go to ever and ever higher levels of integration, starting with the flora and fauna, from beasts all the way to larger and larger ecosystems, right? Each ecosystem just is. It's there. Each ecosystem is self-sustaining. Each ecosystem is anti-fragile. And if you go to the very, very largest ecosystem, that is our planet, Mother Earth. And what this means, we as a civilization, as humans and the ecosystem around us, we are living on this cradle of civilization. It sustains us. Without it, we have nothing. That's nature. Yet, we're falling short. So the question is, in today's day and age, does tech have anything to say about this? Let's start with blockchain. First, the most mundane, the most practical, it's simply a data structure, a chain of blocks, where a block is simply a list of transactions. A slightly bigger picture one, still very sort of techy, is a database with Blue Ocean benefits. A database is simply a way to store data. It's software running on a file system, running on an overall OS. That's just storing stuff. And you can query it, you can index it, and all of that, right? But you can say a blockchain is actually a database too, except it's a new type, a Blue Ocean type of database that gives new characteristics. It's decentralized. No single entity owns or controls it. It's immutable. Once you've written into it, it's there for good. And it has assets. So you essentially own something that's on the blockchain if you have the private key. And this can actually be something digital or financial or even pointing to something physical through digital twin type identities. Let's go to higher levels yet. People call blockchains trust machines. Why? Well, because it minimizes the amount of trust you need to operate. Think about if you want to transfer some money from a bank account in, say, Canada, where I'm from, to, say, here in Germany, where I live now. That would normally cost me about $40. Why? Because it has to go through three or four intermediate banks. Each bank, you're paying about $10 for their trust, for being big and for being 100 years old and all of that, right? Imagine if you could have something that is even more trustworthy, more secure, but only costs pennies to transfer. That's what blockchains enable, because it's actually leveraging technology in a new way, cryptography, building blocks, etc. So trust machines minimize the trust needed to operate. What this does is it allows larger organizations to emerge without having humans in the middle. If you had to ask me, one of the most important things of all characteristics is that blockchains are incentive machines. You can get people to do stuff with them. How? Well, if they do that thing you want, then you pay them with tokens. Magic internet money, some people call it. And these networks, of course, are self-sustaining. They're really, really hard to kill. To kill Bitcoin, you'd actually have to take out every single one of those 6,000 nodes. And there's always going to be a handful of 10 people or maybe 10,000 that will take those to their grave, right? So it means that they're very anti-fragile too. Let's keep going, higher levels for how to frame blockchain. There's this concept of a decentralized autonomous organization, or DAO. And what it is, it's a computational process that's running autonomously on decentralized infrastructure, which means, you know, you can't pull the plug, not Bezos, not anyone. And it's got resource manipulation. It's got its own wallet. Another way to frame this is it's code that can own stuff. Think computer virus that's benevolent. So this is a very powerful concept, right? It's kind of running around there and so on. And you can think of Bitcoin as a DAO or Ethereum, but the things running on top too, the different applications running on top. These are basically these smart contracts or processes that are just out there and running, right? In fact, some people, such as Ralph Merkel, a very famous cryptographer and nanoscientist, has called them life forms.
Ralph Merkel, founder of the Merkel tree and a cryptography legend, stated, quote, "Bitcoin is the first example of a new form of life. It lives and breathes on the internet. It lives because it can pay people to keep it alive. It lives because it performs a useful service that people will pay it to perform. It lives because anyone, anywhere, can run a copy of its code. It lives because all the running copies are constantly talking to each other. It lives because if any one copy is corrupted, it is discarded quickly and without any fuss or muss. It lives because it is radically transparent. Anyone can see its code and see exactly what it does," end quote.
AI. So the original definitions of AI, as conceived by Alan Turing, is essentially to replicate human cognitive behavior, to basically mimic what a human does. And it's best exemplified by the Turing test, trying to decide whether someone behind a wall is a human or a computer as they pass messages back and forth. So now let's combine these, AI and blockchain, especially in something that I call AI DAOs. Artificial intelligent, decentralized autonomous organizations. There's a whole bunch of ways you can make AI DAOs. You start with a DAO, you add AI, or you start with AI, you put it on a decentralized substrate. Or you start with software as a service, which is basically, you know, some company running something. You turn that into a DAO, which is basically giving the same service, and then you add AI. Or you can even take a physical service and turn it into an AI DAO as well. So these things don't need to live just on networks. They can actually have bodies attached. So I've talked about a few of these things, right? I've talked about nature, sustainability, AI, blockchain, AI DAOs. How does this all unify? We've talked about self-driving cars in the past. Well, what if these cars owned themselves? Every single car was its own agent that had its own wallet. If it had to get repaired, it would go to the shop, et cetera, et cetera. This is possible, right? So we would have self-driving, self-owning cars interacting with the ecosystem around it. We don't have to stop with the cars and trucks. The roads themselves can be self-owning, right? Self-owning roads. Self-owning wind farms, right? This is where we can head. Self-owning power grids. We talk about changing the incentives to be carbon neutral. That's a great objective function for a blockchain, right? Self-owning grids. This is possible with today's technology. This is an example of nature bonding with the machines. You can go the other direction too. You can take a machine and make it more nature-like, such as Plantoid. It literally relies on humans to come along and make copies of it, but it incentivizes them because it gives them tokens to do so. And of course, we can have ever higher levels of integration. We can start with the beasts, the tiers, as in German, at the lowest level, to higher and higher ecosystems, the roads, the power grids, to swarms of these things together, right? Connected, of course, with IoT, machine-to-machine, all that sort of thing, right? Guess what? Each of these cars doesn't need an identity, doesn't need ownership. It doesn't have a concept of scarcity. It doesn't have a concept of money, even. It just is. Self-sustaining, anti-fragile. And we go to higher levels too, right? The swarms, etc. They don't have identity, ownership, scarcity, or money. They just are. Self-sustaining, anti-fragile. This is nature 2.0. It's biology and machines in symbiosis, simply providing towards abundance. Together, it's an upgrade to this cradle of civilization that we call nature.
All right, we'll stop it right there. I do question whether it's too much of Trent McConaughey, and it might be too long of a clip, but he said so much. It's actually a 25-minute, it's kind of like a TED Talk that he did in 2018, and he just covers so much of what I've been seeing. And of course, I'm not necessarily agreeing with everything he's saying, because he's seeing this as a positive development. And this is the greater conversation with this film, is that a lot of these technologies that mimic nature, it's opening up that two-way street, you know, that Chuck Missler used to talk about. He used to talk about, yes, we are building this bridge into this digital realm, but there's a two-way street. There's also a bridge being built back. And so this is a great example of how that looks, is the concept of software and hardware. When you think about software, it's just code, it's algorithms, it's numbers on a screen. And it can operate just in a virtual environment where you're looking through a screen and you're looking into a constructed, not real world. And those algorithms, those codes can operate there. Or you can extract those algorithms and embody it into a robot. And that robot can carry out the code. And so if you do that, then the code is actually in the physical world, embodied in some kind of physical form. And this is where, you know, the image of the beast and those conversations become very interesting, especially the mark of the beast. Image of the beast has to do with the economy, has to do with this abstraction, this image. I have to put it in the film because, again, it's built up over the years. And if I don't concisely put it in the film, I just ramble on and on, and it doesn't make much sense to anybody who's not doing the research. So this is part of the process. There's a couple things that I want to address because I know it's on people's minds. First of all, do I own Bitcoin? Yes, I do. Not going to disclose the amount, but I do own it. And second of all, I think Bitcoin is, in a sense, in the short term, is a sort of hedge against the, who knows what's going to happen with the fiat system, the US dollar especially. You know, the US dollar as the world reserve currency, it's the world that I was born into, and it's the world that a lot of people are comfortable with. However, there are problems. They can just print more, just keep printing more. And more people are realizing this. And so it is sort of the beginning of the breakdown of society. If your economic system and your governments are not doing the ethical thing and the publicly acknowledged ethical thing, and everyone can see it, but they're still asking the citizen to pay their taxes, to, you know, pay their debts and all this kind of stuff, there is a breakdown happening. So to hedge against that, something like a digital asset, an immutable digital asset like Bitcoin, is something to consider. Now, I also think that whether by design or not, and again, I talk a little bit more about the origins of Bitcoin, although not really. You know, I know there's lots of documentaries and blogs and everyone speculates about the origins, and I don't want to focus on that because it doesn't matter at this point. It really doesn't matter at this point who created it, because it's out there, it's doing its thing, and it changed computing. It created a biological bridge to computing in a way that I think is different, because it's not just in terms of some kind of one-to-one biology to machine. It's in this context of networks. It's in this context of an ecosystem, and that's much different. It's much bigger than us individually, which all points to ultimately the kingdom of God and how we are all to be of one mind with Christ, as Paul talked about, those things are already there. And that's, again, another point that I made in the last film, but I think it's worth mentioning again, that there is this hive mind, so to speak, of Christ. It's important to keep that in mind because that's way greater. It's the real thing, not this counterfeit stuff that we're seeing everywhere. Bitcoin is an abstraction, and abstractions can be understood as a counterfeit. It depends on how it's used. But really, the thing that the world uses as a monetary, a way to store value and to transfer value, that's what money is. It's this technology. And you can study the history of money from seashells to, you know, coins to bills to now credit and debt and digital. It's come back where digital just made things way out of control, but Bitcoin is grounding the digital into the physical realm. And there's an author named Jason P. Lowry who talks about this, and he's got an interesting background with the Space Force and MIT and stuff like that, and he's a very smart guy. And he wrote a whole book called Soft War, and he's talking about using the Bitcoin network as a way to reground the digital realm into the physical realm by infusing it. And the whole idea of proof of work, meaning you have to burn energy for the network to sustain itself, that is a type of pressure. Just like the clip had there, you know, the idea of the robot whose sole survival is based on humans copying the robot and making more of it. But then if you do, you get paid. It's like this incentive structure. The same kind of thing is taking place with Bitcoin and energy, where, yeah, it takes a lot of energy, but it causes mankind and the corporations and everybody else to consider how they can more efficiently use energy, and especially if that energy is being used to power the Bitcoin network, then you're really figuring out a way to participate in a much bigger thing here that powers this internet money. And so it's a big idea, but that's what's happening now. The changes are happening. It's starting to go from your cypherpunks to your anarchists to your libertarians, and now it's getting to Wall Street and everybody else, BlackRock getting involved. And part of the reason why I think they are is because I think they even see that this is a hedge against the dollar. We don't know what's going to happen with the dollar here coming up. Bitcoin can be a great hedge for the wealthy to store all their wealth because of the types of characteristics that it has. Now, that's the short term. If we're talking about midterm to long term, again, who knows? But based on the thesis of this film, the biological nature of it, there's the biological nature of Bitcoin, the network itself, how it acts like nature, how it looks like swarms in nature. It kind of has a similar type of effect. And where does the trouble come in? Well, in my opinion, it's when humans begin to tie themselves into the blockchain. Now, what I mean by that, I have a whole title sequence here. Maybe I'll just play that for viewer. I was going to play this for people who are already in canarycry.tube into the a focus group. You'll see this as part of the, you know, when you log into the application and everything else. But this is just a series of headlines that have to do with, and it goes quick. It goes quick, so you may have to pause it to read it and everything. But this is a whole bunch of headlines that talk about DNA and crypto and blockchains. So I'll just play the sequence here.
If we entrust a single central entity with all the algorithms and all the data, we must ask ourselves, can we entrust a single entity, be it a corporation or a government, with all of our sensitive information? So how do we avoid pitfalls of centralization, but at the same time be able to build collective intelligence? I believe the answer lies in nature. Self-organization, I believe, is the answer to how nature accomplishes so much while keeping it decentralized.
All right, there it is. So yeah, the last little Medium article, they're inscribing DNA into Bitcoin. So that's going in one direction. So inscribing your DNA into the Bitcoin blockchain, which becomes immutable. And the other one is to put your private keys, or basically your password, to your Bitcoin wallet, encrypt that in your own DNA. And it's a newer type of technology that they've been working on for a few years. And there's some barriers currently, at least in terms of public knowledge, let alone the ethical implications of this. But storing information on DNA is going to become a topic that's more and more relevant. I know it sounds crazy, but I mean, you know, things that sounded crazy 10 years ago are basically rolling out now. So I don't think it's crazy to say that storing information, and especially private information, on your on your literal DNA, becoming a a practice of modern or young technocrats or something like that. That's something that we'll probably see, and I don't know that it's going to spread throughout the world, but it could be the type of thing that really separates the wheat from the tares. You know, if you're part of this whole network, and if you want to validate and participate in this economy, this new digital economy, you have to validate yourself. You can't just jump in and willy nilly. No, you got to validate yourself. And this sounds a lot like what's mentioned there in Revelation 13. So these are just warnings about the long term, mid to long term nature of Bitcoin. Not only itself becomes more biological, but also in terms of how our own biology is affected by it. I do have this one more clip here, and maybe that'll be it for the sharing for right now. It is a clip from a gentleman named Giovanni. I forget his last name. What was his last name? He's got Satostasi or something like that. I don't know. It's like an Italian name or something. And he, let me just play it. Let me just play the segment here.
This connection between the blockchain and biology, more specifically through Bitcoin, is further validated through the analysis of Giovanni Satostasi, a renowned PhD in physics and astrophysicist turned Bitcoin analyst, who claims to have uncovered something called the Bitcoin power law.
Power laws show up when you have networks and when you are, in fact, even biology. They are everywhere in nature, these are power laws. And why they are so important? Because in biology, you know, the body is a network too. You know, the cells communicate with each other. There is information moving here and there. And so this is why we see in biology these power laws, because they are manifestations of things that interact together, and there are feedback loops, you know? So it's a way of understanding the world in a sense. And it's beautiful because our favorite asset, that, you know, we are all in love with Bitcoin, is behaving in this way. Physicists get excited. Sometimes they make fun of us that we like this power loss a little bit too much, but they are everywhere in nature. And the planet laws that are called the Kepler's law. Eventually, Newton took this Kepler law, and then he was able to show that this motion is due to gravity. This is why they behave in this way. There is a law that governs the motion of this planet. And when this law applies to the motion of planet, it looks like a power law on a log graph. So this is the most exciting part, that this behavior of Bitcoin is not just another curve. It's a power law, and it's a big deal. If you look at the metabolism of animals, right? You take a little mouse, then an elephant, a human being, and you ask a question, okay, how fast is metabolism of the animal? And you plot it, it looks like, again, a beautiful straight line. Very different animals, the mouse, the elephant, etc. But across all these huge sizes, there is some kind of a pattern. And that is fascinating, you know, for a scientist, that is amazing, because you're now, okay, what drives this? Why this is happening? You look at GDP of nations, the GDP of nation, the log of a GDP of nation versus the population size. Again, a beautiful straight line in a log plot. There are many, many, many systems like this in nature and human phenomena, like the cities, the growth of a city, the GDP of a nations behave like power laws. Bitcoin, it's even more amazing because of a blockchain, we can know everything, right? Many transactions, the volume, like very detailed things about a network. But price is one of the most evident things, and probably the thing that most people care about.
All right, there it is. Yeah. So interesting, the Bitcoin power law. This is, of course, looking at the Bitcoin price and sort of the exponential growth of it in dollar terms. We live in this weird time where value and how you store it and how you transact it, those are all things that are being questioned, especially with this new communications network that seems to act like a living entity. So there you have it. Again, I'm sure people who have been with us for a long time, your brains are stirring up, you're going to the research box and you're going to start researching some of this stuff yourself. And maybe it's some stuff that is old news, and that's okay. You know, I this is something that I've had to come to terms with, and this is part of the psychology of filmmaking process. And part of the issue I had early on with my earlier, I guess, versions of Age of Deceit 4, I would put something in the film, and within a week, something else would come out, and that old thing became sort of obsolete. And I was like, all right, well, I guess, you know, this next thing is going to be the thing. But then a week after that, something else would happen. Oh, that thing's got to be. And it got to the point where I was like, I can't say and put everything that's out there into the film. It's just impractical. It doesn't work like that. So I've had to come to terms with stick to the things that are evergreen, stick to the things that are hitting home on the point that I'm trying to make. These are all things that take time to develop as you craft an argument or craft a narrative for the film. And again, you know, when I say narrative, I'm not talking about mainstream corporate news narratives. I'm talking about just the, in terms of the documentary, making a coherent story out of this whole thing. And part of it is documenting how much in the secular world, in the science world, this idea of nature, the imprint of nature is in Bitcoin, whether you're talking about the blockchain side, whether you're talking about the dollar price action, which is what this power law represents. It just seems to have all this mimicking of nature, which is, again, a very interesting development and a proposition that perhaps where this is headed is into the realm of biology. And if we're talking about DAOs, I know I've talked about DAOs for years, and you know that clip that I shared from 2018, the guy was talking about DAOs, and it really it's considering things like the fish, a school of fish, and how that operates, and basically creating an entirely computerized version of that with robots and drones and whatever it is. And there's another aspect to this, and this is where I'm putting together more information right now and sort of digging up all the notes I have over the years and putting together the segment and writing it out and everything, is the role of quantum. So quantum computing being another added component to helping something like the Bitcoin network literally come to life kind of thing. This film is meant for the younger generations who are born into a totally digital world where they may not even know what cash is. You know, I've always talked about, oh, they're going to create a cashless society, and how that's so horrible. And in some ways, and well, many ways it is, if the replacement of that cash is even more centralized and surveilled technology. And that's what, you know, so CBDCs and stuff like that is. Now, Bitcoin has its transparency element, and this is another greater commentary on where we're headed, this virtual panopticon, which is basically this idea that we are going to be monitoring ourselves. You know, the idea of a panopticon, there's a central tower that has 360-degree view of all the inmates, and because they have a gun that can shoot any inmate if they are misbehaving, all the inmates behave because they're afraid of that central tower, right? Well, if that central tower is not just the central tower, but it's other people, other inmates, right? If you see that guy over there, he's not following the rules. He can either tell the central authority or take him out himself. That's the kind of decentralized world we're going to live in, where the surveillance apparatus is not going to just be the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, and the intelligence apparatus. Yes, they are a major part of the people who ushered in this technology, but no, it's not going to be just them spying on us and things of that nature. It's going to be sort of everybody spying on everybody. And we're moving towards that anyway. If you think about Ring doorbells and things of that nature, we're just monitoring each other. It's not so much the authorities versus the people. It's the people versus the people. And this is what's going to create the network states, where ideologies will be very much present and represented on a blockchain. And I just see a whole shift in society with all this stuff. And this film will be for those people who are in the thick of it in the next 10, 15 years. And hopefully, you know, Lord willing, this type of content will resonate with those people in the coming years and can maybe find Christ amidst all the chaos that they may find themselves in the next few years. So anyway, I can ramble on about this all day. And again, there's so much more to be put together on the film-wise. I do want to have it done in the next couple months. So I have most of it ready in terms of the content. It's just a matter of sharing it with you guys and getting some feedback, especially those of you in the focus group. So things to keep in mind, what to expect if you are in the focus group already. Once the focus group commences, you'll get an email with a login credential and you'll gain access like that. You'll have a link. You just click on the link, go in there, log in. And once it's live, you'll be able to watch a little introduction from me and also the clips, parts that I've shown in today's episode, but in their entirety, and, you know, not me stopping every so often, just so you get a better flow of the film. I think it'll be about once a week or so, we'll share another clip, and you'll continue to get access to that before anybody else. And while you're watching it, definitely take notes, because after the video ends, you'll be prompted to fill out a little survey for each segment, and this will prompt specific questions about the video or just anything else. I actually, even in my run through here and me recording this, I already noticed a couple mistakes. I forgot to say a line in one of the quotes, little things like that. I know there's mistakes. There's always mistakes. So let me know if you catch those. Your answers will be cataloged, and again, it will be put into a nice spreadsheet for me to look at, and I can assess what I need to do to fix the film and make it better. And we may include some other group chats or some Q&A sessions or something like that. I haven't decided yet. And once it's complete, we will release the film. And the idea is to have it on our own platform, of course, and that's part of the CanaryCry.tube thing. But it is also, you know, we're going to put it on Rumble. We'll throw it up on YouTube, see what happens. We'll get it out there, make it public, and you guys can start sharing it and whatever. I don't expect it to, I don't know. I guess I shouldn't have any expectations for it, but I don't expect the film to have the kind of traction that Age of Deceit, the first one, did. Each film has gone down in interactive, interest or whatever it is, which is fine. That's normal. You're not always going to hit it out of the park. But again, that's not the point. The point isn't to make the most popular movie ever. It's really to have something, a piece of content out there for the Remnant Church and for the generation that are going to be born into a highly digitized world. Them to be able to make sense of things eschatologically and still see Jesus in all of this in his totality and not some kind of abstract version of him. This whole thing, it's not a VIP comment section. I don't want people to think that, oh, it's just a special comment section for people. No, it's more than that. Your names will be included at the end of the film. I will put your name into the credits, and you will be credited as producers of the film. So pretty cool. So I'm looking forward to seeing all of you who are already in, see what you think about this stuff. But also, if you are interested in interacting at that next level, definitely consider joining us at canarycry.tube. And if not, that's fine. You know, you can comment, you can drop a free comment on wherever you're watching this, and we may see it. And, you know, if it's really mean, we might get sad, but, you know, we're kind of used to the really mean comments at this point. I think that about does it for this episode. I know it went a little bit long, but it's okay. You know, there's a lot to cover, a lot to talk about. Again, canarycry.tube is where you want to go. If you are having trouble getting there, you can go to canarycry.party and just click on that third button there where it says canarycry.tube and AOD4 focus group, and it'll take you right to the page there. Also, if you're not into PayPal, if you want to have other ways to support without PayPal, you can go to canarycry.support and you'll see a big blue area where you can jump in at any level. And what we have here is an encouragement to cancel one of your current subscriptions, whether it's to Netflix or Disney or YouTube Premium, and instead support canarycry.tube, get in on the Age of Deceit 4 focus group, and be a part of this small yet very powerful, because we have the power of Christ behind us, movement here. And if you scroll down on canarycry.support, you'll see an area where you can send us some crypto, whether it's Bitcoin or Ethereum, Litecoin, Doge, Cardano, XRP. There's other stuff we've accepted over the years. And in fact, you can see how much Bitcoin Canary Cry holds. A little secret there. Not really. It's all public, folks. You can go look at it if you know how to do it. Just send us an email letting us know that that's where you sent your support, and we will properly thank you. So, that being said, thank you very much for being here. I appreciate it. I appreciate those of you who've been around for 10 plus years on this crazy journey of ours, and I hope that I am able to deliver on creating something that's going to share the gospel message to a generation that needs to hear it in the context that may speak to them more so than anybody else. So there you have it. Hope everyone has an awesome day. See you guys next week on another episode of Canary Cry News Talk. But until then, think outside the cage.